for women today in America if one person can grow through another. That is, if the woman can realize her own potential through her husband and children. We do not know if this is possible or not, he said. The new theorists of the self, who are men, have usually evaded the question of self-realization for a woman. Bemused themselves by the feminine mystique, they assume that there must be some strange difference which permits a woman to find self-realization by living through her husband and children, while men must grow to theirs. It is still very difficult, even for the most advanced psychological theorist, to see woman as a separate self, a human being who, in that respect, is no different in her need to grow than is a man. Most of the conventional theories about women, as well as the feminine mystique, are based on this difference. But the actual basis for this difference is the fact that the possibility for true self-realization has not existed for women until now. Many psychologists, including Freud, have made the mistake of assuming from observations of women who did not have the education and the freedom to play their full part in the world that it was women's essential nature to be passive, conformist, dependent, fearful, childlike. Just as Aristotle, basing his picture of human nature on his own culture and particular period of time, made the mistake of assuming that just because a man was a slave, this was his essential nature and therefore it was good for him to be a slave. Now that education, freedom, the right to work in the great human frontiers, all the roads by which men have realized themselves, are open to women, only the shadow of the past enshrined in the mystique of feminine fulfillment keeps women from finding their road. The mystique promises women sexual fulfillment through abdication of self. But there is massive statistical evidence that the very opening to American women of those roads to their own identity in society brought a real and dramatic increase in women's capacity for sexual fulfillment, the orgasm. In the years between the emancipation of women won by the feminists and the sexual counter-revolution of the feminine mystique, American women enjoyed a decade-by-decade increase in sexual orgasm. And the women who enjoyed this the most fully were, above all, the women who went furthest on the road to self-realization, women who were educated for active participation in the world outside the home. This evidence is found in two famous studies, generally not cited for this purpose. The first of these, the Kinsey Report, was based on interviews with 5,940 women who grew up in the various decades of the 20th century during which the emancipation of women was won, and before the era of the feminine mystique. Even according to Kinsey's measure of sexual fulfillment, the orgasm, which many psychologists, sociologists, and analysts have criticized for its narrow mechanistic over physiological emphasis and its disregard of basic psychological nuances, his study shows a dramatic increase in sexual fulfillment during these decades. The increase began with the generation born between 1900 and 1909, who were maturing and marrying in the 1920s, the era of feminism, the winning of the vote, and the great emphasis on women's rights, independence, careers, and equality with men, including the right to sexual fulfillment. The increase in wives reaching orgasm and the decrease in frigid women continued in each succeeding generation down to the youngest generation in the Kinsey sample, which was marrying in the 1940s. And the most emancipated women, women educated beyond college for professional careers, showed a far greater capacity for complete sexual enjoyment, full orgasm, than the rest. Contrary to the feminine mystique, the Kinsey figures showed that the more educated the woman, the more likely she was to enjoy full sexual orgasm more often, and the less likely to be frigid. The greater sexual enjoyment of women who had completed college compared to those who had not gone beyond grade school or high school, and the even greater sexual enjoyment of women who had gone beyond college into higher professional training showed up from the first year of marriage and continued to show up in the 5th, 10th, and 15th years of marriage. While Kinsey found only one American woman in 10 who had never experienced sexual orgasm, the majority of women he interviewed did not experience it completely, all or almost all of the time, except for those women who were educated beyond college. The Kinsey figures also showed that women who married before 20 were least likely to experience sexual orgasm and were likely to enjoy it less frequently in or out of marriage, though they started sexual intercourse 5 or 6 years earlier than women who finished college or graduate school. While the Kinsey data show that over the years, a distinctly higher proportion of the better educated females, in contrast to the grade school and high school females, had actually reached orgasm in a higher percentage of their marital coitus, the increased enjoyment of sex did not, for the most part, mean an increased incidence of it in the woman's life. On the whole, there was a slight trend in the opposite direction, and that increase in extramarital sex was less marked with professionally trained women. Perhaps something about the supposedly unfeminine strength or self-realization achieved by women educated for professional careers enable them to enjoy greater sexual fulfillment in their marriages than other women, as measured by the orgasm, and thus less likely to seek it outside of marriage. Or perhaps they simply had less need to seek status, achievement, or identity in sex. The relationship between woman's sexual fulfillment and self-realization indicated by Kinsey's findings is underlined by the fact that, as many critics have pointed out, Kinsey's sample was overrepresentative of professional women, college graduates, women with unusually high dominance or strength of self. Kinsey's sample underrepresented the typical American housewife who devotes her life to husband, home, and children. It underrepresented women with little education. Because of its use of volunteers, it underrepresented the kind of passive, submissive, conformist women whom Maslow found to be incapable of sexual enjoyment. The increase in sexual fulfillment and decrease in frigidity which Kinsey found during the decades after women's emancipation may not have been felt by the average American housewife as much as by this minority of women who directly experienced emancipation through education and participation in the professions. Nevertheless, the decrease in frigidity was so dramatic in that large, if unrepresentative, sample of nearly 6,000 women that even Kinsey's critics found it significant. It was hardly an accident that this increase in women's sexual fulfillment accompanied her progress to equal participation in the rights, education, work, and decisions of American society. The coincidental sexual emancipation of American men, the lifting of the veil of contempt and degradation from sexual intercourse, was surely related to the American male's new regard for the American woman as an equal, a person like himself, and not just a sexual object. Evidently, the further women progressed from that state, the more sex became an act of human intercourse rather than a dirty joke to men, and the more women were able to love men rather than submit in passive distaste to their sexual desire. In fact, the feminine mystique itself, with its acknowledgement of woman as subject and not just object of the sexual act, and its assumption that her active, willing participation was essential to man's pleasure, could not have come without the emancipation of women to human equality. As the early feminists foresaw, women's rights did indeed promote greater sexual fulfillment for men and women. Other studies also showed that education and independence increased the American woman's ability to enjoy a sexual relationship with a man, and thus to affirm more fully her own sexual nature as a woman. Repeated reports before and after Kinsey showed college-educated women to have a much lower than average divorce rate. More specifically, a massive and famous sociological study by Ernest W. Burgess and Leonard S. Cottrell indicated that women's chance of happiness in marriage increased as their career preparation increased, with teachers, professional nurses, women doctors, and lawyers showing fewer unhappy marriages than any other group of women. These women were more likely to enjoy happiness in marriage than women who held skilled office positions, who in turn had happier marriages than women who had not worked before marriage, or who had no vocational ambition, or who worked at a job that was not in accordance with their own ambitions, or whose only work training or experience was domestic or unskilled. In fact, the higher the woman's income at the time of her marriage, the more probable her married happiness. As the sociologist put it, apparently in the case of wives, the traits that make for success in the business world as measured by monthly income are the traits that make for success in marriage. The point, of course, may be made that income indirectly measures education since the amount of educational training influences income. Among 526 couples, less than 10% showed low marital adjustment where the wife had been employed 7 or more years, had completed college or professional training, and had not married before 22. Where wives had been educated beyond college, less than 5% of marriages scored low in happiness. One might have predicted from such evidence a relatively poor chance of married happiness or of sexual fulfillment or even of orgasm for the women whom the mystique encouraged to marry before 20, to forego higher education, careers, independence, and equality with men in favor of femininity. And, as a matter of fact, the youngest group of wives studied by Kinsey, the generation born between 1920 and 1929, who met the feminine mystique head-on in the 1940s when the race back home began, showed, by the fifth year of marriage, a sharp reversal of that trend toward increased sexual fulfillment in marriage, which had been manifest in every decade since women's emancipation in the 1920s. The percentage of women enjoying orgasm in all or nearly all their married sex life in the fifth year of marriage had risen from 37% of women in the generation born before 1900 to 42% in the generations born in the next two decades. The youngest group, whose fifth year of marriage was in the late 1940s, enjoyed full orgasm in even less cases, 36%, than women born before 1900. Would a new Kinsey study find the young wives who are products of the feminine mystique enjoying even less sexual fulfillment than their more emancipated, more independent, more educated, more grown-up when married forebears? Only 14% of Kinsey's women had married by 20. A bare majority, 53%, had married by 25, though most did marry. This is quite a difference from the America of the 1960s, when 50% of women marry in their teens. Recently, Helene Deutsch, the eminent psychoanalyst, who went even further than Freud in equating femininity with masochistic passivity and in warning women that outward-directed activity and masculinizing intellectuality might interfere with a fully feminine orgasm, threw a psychoanalytic conference into an uproar by suggesting that perhaps too much emphasis had been put on the orgasm for women. In the 1960s, she was suddenly not so sure that women had to have or could have a real orgasm. Perhaps a more diffuse fulfillment was all that could be expected. After all, she had women patients who were absolutely psychotic who seemed to have orgasms, but most women she saw now did not seem to have them at all. What did it mean? Could women then not experience orgasm? Or had something happened during this time when so much emphasis has been placed on sexual fulfillment to keep women from experiencing orgasm? The experts did not all agree. But in other contexts, not concerned with women, analysts reported that passive people who psychologically feel empty, who fail to develop adequate egos, have little sense of their own identity, cannot submit to the experience of sexual orgasm for fear of their own non-existence. Fanned into an all-consuming sexual search by the popularizers of Freudian femininity, many women had, in effect, renounced everything for the orgasm that was supposed to be at the end of the rainbow. To say the least, they directed quite a lot of their emotional energies and needs toward the sexual act. As somebody said about a truly beautiful woman in America, her image has been so overexposed in the ads, television, movies, that when you see the real thing, you're disappointed. Without even delving into the murky depths of the unconscious, one might assume it was asking a lot of the beautiful orgasm, not only to live up to its over-advertised claims, but to constitute the equivalent of an A in sex, a salary raise, a good review on opening night, promotion to senior editor or associate professor, much less the basic experience of oneself, the sense of identity. As one psychotherapist reported, "One of the major reasons, ironically, why so many women are not achieving full flowering sexuality today is because they are so overdetermined to achieve it. They are so ashamed if they do not reach the heights of expressive sensuality that they tragically sabotage their own desires. That is to say, instead of focusing clearly on the real problem at hand, these women are focusing on quite a different problem, namely, oh, what an idiot and incompetent person I am for not being able to achieve satisfaction without difficulty." Today's women are often obsessed with the notion of how, rather than what, they are doing when they are having marital relations. That is fatal. If sex itself, as another psychoanalyst put it, is beginning to have a depressive quality in America, it is perhaps because too many Americans, especially the women sex seekers, are putting into the sexual search all their frustrated needs for self-realization. American women are suffering, quite simply, a massive sickness of sex without self. No one has warned them that sex can never be a substitute for personal identity, that sex itself cannot give identity to a woman any more than to a man, that there may be no sexual fulfillment at all for the woman who seeks herself in sex. The question of how a person can most fully realize his own capacities and thus achieve identity has become an important concern of the philosophers and the social and psychological thinkers of our time, and for good reason. Thinkers of other times put forth the idea that people were, to a great extent, defined by the work they did. the work that a man had to do to eat, to stay alive, to meet the physical necessities of his environment, dictated his identity. And in this sense, when work is seen merely as a means of survival, human identity was dictated by biology. But today, the problem of human identity has changed. For the work that defined man's place in society and his sense of himself has also changed man's world. Work and the advance of knowledge has lessened man's dependence on his environment. His biology and the work he must do for biological survival are no longer sufficient to define his identity. This can be most clearly seen in our own abundant society. Men no longer need to work all day to eat. They have an unprecedented freedom to choose the kind of work they will do. They also have an unprecedented amount of time apart from the hours and days that must actually be spent in making a living. And suddenly one realizes the significance of today's identity crisis for women and increasingly for men. One sees the human significance of work not merely as the means of biological survival, but as the giver of self and the transcender of self, as the creator of human identity and human evolution. For self-realization or self-fulfillment or identity does not come from looking into a mirror in rapt contemplation of one's own image. Those who have most fully realized themselves in a sense that can be recognized by the human mind, even though it cannot be clearly defined, have done so in the service of a human purpose larger than themselves. Men from varying disciplines have used different words for this mysterious process from which comes the sense of self. The religious mystics, the philosophers, Marx, Freud, all had different names for it. Man finds himself by losing himself. Man is defined by his relation to the means of production. The ego, the self, grows through understanding and mastering reality, through work and love. The identity crisis, which has been noted by Eric Erickson and others in recent years in The American Man, seems to occur for lack of and be cured by finding the work or cause or purpose that evokes his own creativity. Some never find it, for it does not come from busy work or punching a time clock. It does not come from just making a living, working by formula, finding a secure spot as an organization man. The very argument by Reisman and others that man no longer finds identity in the work defined as a paycheck job assumes that identity for man comes through creative work of his own that contributes to the human community. The core of the self becomes aware, becomes real, and grows through work that carries forward human society. Work, the shop-worn staple of the economists, has become the new frontier of psychology. Psychiatrists have long used occupational therapy with patients in mental hospitals. They have recently discovered that to be of real psychological value, it must be not just therapy, but real work serving a real purpose in the community. And work can now be seen as the key to the problem that has no name. The identity crisis of American women began a century ago, as more and more of the work important to the world, more and more of the work that used their human abilities and through which they were able to find self-realization, was taken from them. Until, and even into the last century, strong, capable women were needed to pioneer our new land. With their husbands, they ran the farms and plantations and western homesteads. These women were respected and self-respecting members of a society whose pioneering purpose centered in the home. Strength and independence, responsibility and self-confidence, self-discipline and courage, freedom and equality were part of the American character for both men and women in all the first generations. The women who came by steerage from Ireland, Italy, Russia, and Poland worked beside their husbands in the sweatshops and the laundries, learned the new language, and saved to send their sons and daughters to college. Women were never quite as feminine or held in as much contempt in America as they were in Europe. American women seemed to European travelers long before our time less passive, childlike, and feminine than their own wives in France or Germany or England. By an accident of history, American women shared in the work of society longer and grew with the men. Grade and high school education for boys and girls alike was almost always the rule, and in the West, where women shared the pioneering work the longest, even the universities were co-educational from the beginning. The identity crisis for women did not begin in America until the fire and strength and ability of the pioneer women were no longer needed, no longer used, in the middle-class homes of the eastern and midwestern cities, when the pioneering was done and men began to build a new society and industries and professions outside the home. But the daughters of the pioneer women had grown too used to freedom and work to be content with leisure and passive femininity. It was not an American, but a South African woman, Mrs. Olive Schreiner, who warned at the turn of the century that the quality and quantity of women's functions in the social universe were decreasing as fast as civilization was advancing, that if women did not win back their right to a full share of honored and useful work, woman's mind and muscle would weaken in a parasitic state. Her offspring, male and female, would weaken progressively, and civilization itself would deteriorate. The feminists saw clearly that education and the right to participate in the more advanced work of society were women's greatest needs. They fought for and won the rights to new, fully human identity for women. But how very few of their daughters and granddaughters have chosen to use their education and their abilities for any large creative purpose for responsible work in society. How many of them have been deceived or have deceived themselves into clinging to the outgrown, childlike femininity of occupation housewife. It was not a minor matter, their mistaken choice. We now know that the same range of potential ability exists for women as for men. Women, as well as men, can only find their identity in work that uses their full capacities. A woman cannot find her identity through others, her husband, her children. She cannot find it in the dull routine of housework. As thinkers of every age have said, it is only when a human being faces squarely the fact that he can forfeit his own life, that he becomes truly aware of himself and begins to take his existence seriously. Sometimes this awareness comes only at the moment of death. Sometimes it comes from a more subtle facing of death, the death of self in passive conformity, in meaningless work. The feminine mystique prescribes just such a living death for women. Faced with the slow death of self, the American woman must begin to take her life seriously. "We measure ourselves by many standards," said the great American psychologist William James nearly a century ago. "Our strength and our intelligence, our wealth, and even our good luck are things which warm our heart and make us feel ourselves a match for life, but deeper than all such things, and able to suffice unto itself without them, is the sense of the amount of effort which we can put forth. If women do not put forth finally that effort to become all that they have it in them to become, they will forfeit their own humanity. A woman today who has no goal, no purpose, no ambition patterning her days into the future, making her stretch and grow beyond that small score of years in which her body can fill its biological function, is committing a kind of suicide. For that future half a century after the childbearing years are over is a fact that an American woman cannot deny, nor can she deny that as a housewife, the world is indeed rushing past her door while she just sits and watches. The terror she feels is real if she has no place in that world. The feminine mystique has succeeded in burying millions of American women alive. There is no way for these women to break out of their comfortable concentration camps except by finally putting forth an effort, that human effort which reaches beyond biology, beyond the narrow walls of home, to help shape the future. Only by such a personal commitment to the future can American women break out of the housewife trap and truly find fulfillment as wives and mothers by fulfilling their own unique possibilities as separate human beings. Chapter 14. A New Life Plan for Women. "Easy enough to say," the woman inside the housewife's trap remarks, "but what can I do alone in the house with the children yelling and the laundry to sort and no grandmother to babysit? It is easier to live through someone else than to become complete yourself. The freedom to lead and plan your own life is frightening if you have never faced it before. It is frightening when a woman finally realizes that there is no answer to the question, 'Who am I?' except the voice inside herself. She may spend years on the analyst's couch, working out her adjustment to the feminine role, her blocks to fulfillment as a wife and mother, and still the voice inside her may say, 'That's not it.' Even the best psychoanalyst can only give her the courage to listen to her own voice. When society asks so little of women, every woman has to listen to her own inner voice to find her identity in the changing world. She must create, out of her own needs and abilities, a new life plan, fitting in the love and children and home that have defined femininity in the past with the work toward a greater purpose that shapes the future. To face the problem is not to solve it. But once a woman faces it, as women are doing today all over America without much help from the experts, when she asks herself, "What do I want to do?" she begins to find her own answers. Once she begins to see through the delusions of the feminine mystique and realizes that neither her husband nor her children, nor the things in her house, nor sex, nor being like all the other women can give herself, she often finds the solution much easier than she anticipated. Of the many women I talked to in the suburbs and cities, some were just beginning to face the problem, others were well on their way to solving it, and for still others it was no longer a problem. In the stillness of an April afternoon with all her children in school, a woman told me, "I put all my energies into the children, carting them around, worrying about them, teaching them things. Suddenly, there was this terrible feeling of emptiness. All that volunteer work I'd taken on, scouts, PTA, the league, just didn't seem worth doing all of a sudden. As a girl, I wanted to be an actress. It was too late to go back to that. I stayed in the house all day, cleaning things I hadn't cleaned in years. I spent a lot of time just crying. My husband and I talked about it's being an American woman's problem, how you give up a career for the children, and then you reach a point where you can't go back. I felt so envious of the few women I know who had a definite skill and kept working at it. My dream of being an actress wasn't real. I didn't work at it. Did I have to throw my whole self into the children? I've spent my whole life just immersed in other people and never even knew what kind of a person I was myself. Now I think even having another baby wouldn't solve that emptiness long. You can't go back. You have to go on. There must be some real way I can go on myself." This woman was just beginning her search for identity. Another woman had made it to the other side and could look back now and see the problem clearly. Her home was colorful, casual, but technically she was no longer just a housewife. She was paid for her work as a professional painter. She told me that when she stopped conforming to the conventional picture of femininity, she finally began to enjoy being a woman, she said. "I used to work so hard to maintain this beautiful picture of myself as a wife and mother. I had all of my children by natural childbirth. I breastfed them all. I got mad once at an older woman at a party when I said, 'Childbirth is the most important thing in life, the basic animal,' and she said, 'Don't you want to be more than an animal?' 'You do want something more, only you don't know what it is. So you put even more into housekeeping. It's not challenging enough, just ironing dresses for your little girls. So you go in for ruffly dresses that need more ironing, and bake your own bread, and refuse to get a dishwasher. You think if you make a big enough challenge out of it, then somehow it would be satisfying. And still it wasn't. I almost had an affair. I used to feel so discontented with my husband. I used to feel outraged if he didn't help with the housework. I insisted that he do dishes, scrub floors, everything. We wouldn't quarrel, but you can't deceive yourself sometimes in the middle of the night. I couldn't seem to control this feeling that I wanted something more from life. So I went to a psychiatrist. He kept trying to make me enjoy being feminine, but it didn't help. And then I went to one who seemed to make me find out who I was and forget about this beautiful feminine picture. I realized I was furious at myself, furious at my husband, because I'd left school. I used to put the kids in the car and just drive because I couldn't bear to be alone in the house. I kept wanting to do something, but I was afraid to try. One day on a back road, I saw an artist painting, and it was like a voice I couldn't control saying, 'Do you give lessons?' I'd take care of the house and kids all day, and after I finished the dishes at night, I'd paint. Then I took the bedroom we were going to use for another baby, 5 children was part of my beautiful picture, and used it for a studio for myself. I remember one night working and working, and suddenly it was 2 a.m., and I was finished. I looked at the picture, and it was like finding myself. I can't think what I was trying to do with my life before, trying to fit some picture of an old-time woman pioneer. I don't have to prove I'm a woman by sewing my own clothes. I am a woman, and I am myself, and I buy clothes and love them. I'm not such a darned patient, loving, perfect mother anymore. I don't change the kids' clothes top to bottom every day, and no more ruffles. But I seem to have more time to enjoy them. I don't spend much time on housework now, but it's done before my husband gets home. We bought a dishwasher. The longer it takes to wash dishes, the less time you have for anything else. It's not creative doing the same thing over and over. Why should a woman feel guilty at getting rid of this repetitive work? There's no virtue in dishwashing, scrubbing floors. Dacron, dishwashers, drip dry. This is fine. This is the direction physical life should take. This is our time, our only time on earth. We can't keep throwing it away. My time is all I've got, and this is what I want to do with it. I don't need to make such a production of my marriage now because it's real. Somehow, once I began to have the sense of myself, I became aware of my husband. Before, it was like he was part of me, not a separate human being. I guess it was until I stopped trying to be feminine that I began to enjoy being a woman. And then there were others, teetering back and forth, aware of the problem, but not yet quite sure what to do about it. The chairman of a suburban fundraising committee said, "I envy Jean who stays at home and does the work she wants to do. I haven't opened my easel in 2 months. I keep getting so involved in committees I don't care about. It's the thing to do to get in with the crowd here, but it doesn't make me feel quiet inside the way I feel when I paint. An artist in the city told me, you should take yourself more seriously. You could be an artist and a housewife and a mother, all three. I guess the only thing that stops me is that it's hard work." A young Ohio woman told me, "Lately I felt this need. I felt we simply had to have a bigger house, put on an addition, or move to a better neighborhood. I went on a frantic round of entertaining, but that was like living for the interruptions of your life. My husband thinks that being a good mother is the most important career there is. I think it's even more important than a career, but I don't think most women are all mother. I enjoy my kids, but I don't like spending all my time with them. I'm just not their age. I can make housework take up more of my time, but the floors don't need vacuuming more than twice a week. My mother swept them every day. I always wanted to play the violin. When I went to college, girls who took music seriously were peculiar. Suddenly, it was as if some voice inside me said, 'Now is the time. You'll never get another chance.' I felt embarrassed, practicing at 40. It exhausts me and hurts my shoulder, but it makes me feel at one with something larger than myself. The universe suddenly becomes real, and you're a part of it. You feel as if you really exist. It would be quite wrong for me to offer any woman easy how-to answers to this problem. There are no easy answers in America today. It is difficult, painful, and takes perhaps a long time for each woman to find her own answer. First, she must unequivocally say no to the housewife image. This does not mean, of course, that she must divorce her husband, abandon her children, give up her home. She does not have to choose between marriage and career. That was the mistaken choice of the feminine mystique. In actual fact, it is not as difficult as the feminine mystique implies to combine marriage and motherhood and even the kind of lifelong personal purpose that once was called career. It merely takes a new life plan in terms of one's whole life as a woman. The first step in that plan is to see housework for what it is, not a career, but something that must be done as quickly and efficiently as possible. Once a woman stops trying to make cooking, cleaning, washing, ironing something more, she can say, "No, I don't want a stove with rounded corners. I don't want 4 different kinds of soap." She can say no to those mass daydreams of the women's magazines and television, no to the depth researchers and manipulators who are trying to run her life. Then she can use the vacuum cleaner and the dishwasher and all the automatic appliances and even the instant mashed potatoes for what they are truly worth, to save time that can be used in more creative ways. The second step, and perhaps the most difficult for the products of sex-directed education, is to see marriage as it really is, brushing aside the veil of over-glorification imposed by the feminine mystique. Many women I talked to felt strangely discontented with their husbands, continually irritated with their children when they saw marriage and motherhood as the final fulfillment of their lives. But when they began to use their various abilities with the purpose of their own in society, they not only spoke of a new feeling of, aliveness or completeness in themselves, but of a new, though hard to define, difference in the way they felt about their husbands and children. Many echoed this woman's words. The funny thing is, I enjoy my children more now that I've made room for myself. Before, when I was putting my whole self into the children, it was as if I was always looking for something through them. I couldn't just enjoy them as I do now, as though they were a sunset, something outside me, separate. Before, I felt so tied down by them. I try to get away in my mind. Maybe a woman has to be by herself, to be really with her children. A New England lawyer's wife told me, I thought I had finished. I had come to the end of childhood, had married, had a baby, and I was happy with my marriage. But somehow I was disconsolate because I assumed this was the end. I would take up upholstery one week, Sunday painting the next. My house was spotless. I devoted entirely too much time to entertaining my child. He didn't need all that adult companionship. A grown woman playing with the child all day, disintegrating herself in 100 directions to fill the time, cooking fancy food when no one needs it, and then furious if they don't eat it. You lose your adult common sense, your whole sense of yourself as a human being. Now I'm studying history, one course a year. It's work, but I haven't missed a night in 2.5 years. Soon I'll be teaching. I love being a wife and mother, but I know now that when marriage is the end of your life, because you have no other mission, it becomes a miserable, tawdry thing. Who said women have to be happy, to be amused, to be entertained? You have to work. You don't have to have a job, but you have to tackle something yourself and see it through to feel alive. An hour a day, a weekend, or even a week off from motherhood is not the answer to the problem that has no name. That mother's hour off, as advised by child and family experts or puzzled doctors as the antidote for the housewife's fatigue or trapped feeling, assumes automatically that a woman is just a housewife, now and forever a mother. A person fully used by his work can enjoy time off. But the mothers I talked to did not find any magical relief in an hour off. In fact, they often gave it up on the slightest pretext, either from guilt or from boredom. A woman who has no purpose of her own in society, a woman who cannot let herself think about the future because she is doing nothing to give herself a real identity in it, will continue to feel a desperation in the present, no matter how many hours off she takes. Even a very young woman today must think of herself as a human being first, not as a mother with time on her hands, and make a life plan in terms of her own abilities, a commitment of her own to society, with which her commitments as wife and mother can be integrated. A woman I interviewed, a mental health educator who was for many years just a housewife in her suburban community, sums it up. I remember my own feeling that life wasn't full enough for me. I wasn't using myself in terms of my capacities. It wasn't enough making a home. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. You can't just deny your intelligent mind. You need to be part of the social scheme. And looking over the trees of her garden to the quiet, empty suburban street, she said, "If you knock on any of these doors, how many women would you find whose abilities are being used? You'd find them drinking or sitting around talking to other women and watching children play because they can't bear to be alone, or watching TV or reading a book. Society hasn't caught up with women yet, hasn't found a way yet to use the skills and energies of women except to bear children. Over the last 15 years, I think women have been running away from themselves. The reason the young ones have swallowed this feminine business is because they think if they go back and look for all their satisfaction in the home, it will be easier, but it won't be. Somewhere along the line, a woman, if she is going to come to terms with herself, has to find herself as a person. The only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own. There is no other way. But a job, any job, is not the answer. In fact, it can be part of the trap. Women who do not look for jobs equal to their actual capacity, who do not let themselves develop the lifetime interests and goals which require serious education and training, who take a job at 20 or 40 to help out at home, or just to kill extra time, are walking almost as surely as the ones who stay inside the housewife trap to a non-existent future. If a job is to be the way out of the trap for a woman, it must be a job that she can take seriously as part of a life plan, work in which she can grow as part of society. Suburban communities, particularly the new communities where social, cultural, educational, political, and recreational patterns are not as yet firmly established, offer numerous opportunities for the able, intelligent woman. But such work is not necessarily a job. In Westchester, on Long Island, in the Philadelphia suburbs, women have started mental health clinics, art centers, day camps. In big cities and small towns, women all the way from New England to California have pioneered new movements in politics and education. Even if this work was not thought of as job or career, it was often so important to the various communities that professionals are now being paid for doing it. In some suburbs and communities, there is now little work left for the non-professional that requires intelligence, except for the few positions of leadership, which most women these days lack the independence, the strength, the self-confidence to take. If the community has a high proportion of educated women, there simply are not enough such posts to go around. As a result, community work often expands in a kind of self-serving structure of communities and red tape, in the purest sense of Parkinson's law, until its real purpose seems to be just to keep women busy. Such busy work is not satisfying to mature women, nor does it help the immature to grow. This is not to say that being a den mother or serving on a PTA committee or organizing a covered dish supper is not useful work. For a woman of intelligence and ability, it is simply not enough. One woman I interviewed had involved herself in an endless whirl of worthwhile community activities, but they led in no direction for her own future, nor did they truly utilize her exceptional intelligence. Indeed, her intelligence seemed to deteriorate. She suffered the problem that has no name with increasing severity until she took the first step toward a serious commitment. Today she is a master teacher, a serene wife and mother. At first, I took on the hospital fundraising committee, the clerical volunteers committee for the clinic. I was class mother for the children's field trips. I was taking piano lessons to the tune of $30 a week, paying babysitters so I could play for my own amusement. I did the Dewey Decimal System for the library we started, and the usual den mother and PTA. The financial outlay for all these things, which were only needed to fill up my life, was taking a good slice out of my husband's income. And it still didn't fill up my life. I was cranky and moody. I would burst into tears for no reason. I couldn't even concentrate to finish a detective story. I was so busy running from morning till night, and yet I never had any real feeling of satisfaction. You raise your kids, sure, but how can that justify your life? You have to have some ultimate objective, some long-term goal to keep you going. Community activities are short-term goals. You do a project, it's done, then you have to hunt for another one. In community work, they say you mustn't bother the young mothers with little children. This is the job of the middle-aged ones whose kids are grown, but it's just the ones who are tied down with the kids who need to do this. When you're not tied down by the kids, drop that stuff. You need real work. Because of the feminine mystique, and perhaps because of the simple human fear of failure when one does compete without sexual privilege or excuse, it is the jump from amateur to professional that is often hardest for a woman on her way out of the trap. But even if a woman does not have to work to eat, she can find identity only in work that is of real value to society, work for which usually our society pays. Being paid is, of course, more than a reward. It implies a definite commitment. For fear of that commitment, hundreds of able, educated suburban housewives today fool themselves about the writer or actress they might have been, or dabble at art or music in the dilettante's limbo of self-enrichment, or apply for jobs as receptionists or saleswomen, jobs well below their actual abilities. These are also ways of evading growth. The growing boredom of American women with volunteer work and their preference for paid jobs, no matter how low-level, has been attributed to the fact that professionals have taken over most of the posts in the community requiring intelligence. But the fact that women did not become professionals themselves, the reluctance of women in the last 20 years to commit themselves to work, paid or unpaid, requiring initiative, leadership, and responsibility, is due to the feminine mystique. This attitude of non-commitment among young housewives was confirmed by a recent study done in Westchester County. In the upper-income suburb, more than 50% of a group of housewives between 25 and 35 with husbands in the over $25,000 a year income group wanted to go to work. 13% immediately, the rest in 5 to 15 years. Of those who planned to go to work, 3 out of 4 felt inadequately prepared. All of these women had some college education, but only one a graduate degree. A third had married at 20 or before. These women were not driven to go to work by economic need, but by what the anthropologist who made the survey called the psychological need to be economically productive. Evidently, volunteer work did not meet this need. Though 62% of these women were doing volunteer work, it was of the one day and under variety. And though they wanted jobs and felt inadequately prepared, of the 45% taking courses, very few were working toward a degree. The element of fantasy in their work plans was witnessed by the small business that opened and closed with sad regularity. When an alumni association sponsored a 2-session forum in the suburb on how women in the middle years can return to work, 25 women attended. As a beginning step, each woman was asked to come to the second meeting with a resume. The resume took some thought and, as a researcher put it, sincerity of purpose. Only one woman was serious enough to write the resume. In another suburb, there is a guidance center, which in the early years of the mental health movement gave real scope to the intelligence of college-educated women of the community. They never did therapy, of course, but in the early years they administered the center and led the educational parent discussion groups. Now that education for family living has become professionalized, the center is administered and the discussion groups led by professionals, often brought in from the city, who have MAs or doctorates in the field. In only a very few cases did the women who found themselves in the work of the guidance center go on in the new profession and get their own MAs and PhDs. Most backed off when to continue would have meant breaking away from the housewife role and becoming seriously committed to a profession. Ironically, the only kind of work which permits an able woman to realize her abilities fully, to achieve identity in society in a life plan that can encompass marriage and motherhood, is the kind that was forbidden by the feminine mystique, the lifelong commitment to an art or science, to politics or profession. Such a commitment is not tied to a specific job or locality. It permits year-to-year variation, a full-time paid job in one community, part-time in another, exercise of the professional skill in serious volunteer work, or a period of study during pregnancy or early motherhood when a full-time job is not feasible. It is a continuous thread, kept alive by work and study and contacts in the field and any part of the country. The women I found who had made and kept alive such long-term commitments did not suffer the problem that has no name, nor did they live in the housewife image. But music or art or politics offered no magic solution for the women who did not or could not commit themselves seriously. The arts seem, at first glance, to be the ideal answer for a woman. They can, after all, be practiced in the home. They do not necessarily imply that dreaded professionalism. They are suitably feminine and seem to offer endless room for personal growth and identity with no need to compete in society for pay. But I have noticed that when women do not take up painting or ceramics seriously enough to become professionals, to be paid for their work or for teaching it to others, and to be recognized as a peer by other professionals, sooner or later they cease dabbling. The Sunday painting, the idle ceramics, do not bring that needed sense of self when they are of no value to anyone else. The amateur or dilettante whose own work is not good enough for anyone to want to pay to hear or see or read does not gain real status by it in society, or real personal identity. These are reserved for those who have made the effort, acquired the knowledge and expertise to become professionals. There are, of course, a number of practical problems involved in making a serious professional commitment, but somehow those problems only seem insurmountable when a woman is still half-submerged in the false dilemmas and guilts of the feminine mystique, or when her desire for something more is only fantasy and she is unwilling to make the necessary effort. Over and over, women told me that the crucial step for them was simply to take the first trip to the alumni employment agency, or to send for the application for teacher certification, or to make appointments with former job contacts in the city. It is amazing how many obstacles and rationalizations the feminine mystique can throw up to keep a woman from making that trip or writing that letter. One suburban housewife I knew had once been a newspaper woman, but she was sure she could never get that kind of job again. She had been away too long. And of course, she couldn't really leave her children, who by then were all in school during the day. As it turned out, when she finally decided to do something about it, she found an excellent job in her old field after only two trips into the city. Another woman, a psychiatric social worker, said that she could not take a regular agency job, only volunteer jobs without deadlines that she could put down when she felt like it, because she could not count on a cleaning woman. Actually, if she had hired a cleaning woman, which many of her neighbors were doing for much less reason, she would have had to commit herself to the kind of assignments that would have been a real test of her ability. Obviously, she was afraid of such a test. A great many suburban housewives today step back from or give up volunteer activity, art, or job at the very point when all that is needed is a more serious commitment. The PTA leader won't run for the school board. The League of Women Voters leader is afraid to move on into the rough mainstream of her political party. Women can't get a policy-making role, she says. I'm not going to lick stamps. Of course, it will require more effort for her to win a policy-making role in her party against the prejudices and the competition of the men. Some women take the jobs, but do not make the necessary new life plan. I interviewed two women of ability, both of whom were bored as housewives, and both of whom got jobs in the same research institute. They loved the increasingly challenging work and were quickly promoted. But in their 30s, after 10 years as housewives, they earned very little money. The first woman, clearly recognizing the future this work held for her, spent virtually her entire salary on a three-day-a-week cleaning woman. The second woman, who felt her work was justified only if it helped out with family expenses, would not spend any money for cleaning help, nor does she consider asking her husband and children to help out with household chores or save time by ordering groceries by phone and sending the laundry out. She quit her job after a year from sheer exhaustion. The first woman who made the necessary household changes and sacrifices today at 38 has one of the leading jobs at the Institute and makes a substantial contribution to her family's income over and above what she pays for her part-time household help. The second, after 2 weeks of rest, began to suffer the old desperation. But she persuaded herself that she will cheat her husband and children less by finding work she can do at home. The picture of the happy housewife doing creative work at home, painting, sculpting, writing, is one of the image illusions of the feminine mystique. There are men and women who can do it, but when a man works at home, his wife keeps the children strictly out of the way, or else. It is not so easy for a woman. If she is serious about her work, she often must find some place away from home to do it, or risk becoming an ogre to her children in her impatient demands for privacy. Her attention is divided and her concentration interrupted on the job and as a mother. A no-nonsense 9-to-5 job with a clear division between professional work and housework requires much less discipline and is usually less lonely. Some of the stimulation and the new friendships that come from being part of the professional world can be lost by the woman who tries to fit her career into the physical confines of her housewife life. A woman must say no to the feminine mystique very clearly indeed to sustain the discipline and effort that any professional commitment requires. For the mystique is no mere intellectual construct. A great many people have, or think they have, a vested interest in occupation housewife. However long it may take for women's magazines, sociologists, educators, and psychoanalysts to correct the mistakes that perpetuate the feminine mystique, a woman must deal with them now in the prejudices, mistaken fears, and unnecessary dilemmas voiced by her husband, her friends and neighbors, perhaps her minister, priest, or rabbi, or her child's kindergarten teacher, or the well-meaning social worker at the guidance clinic, or her own innocent little children. But resistance, from whatever source, is better seen for what it is. Even the traditional resistance of religious orthodoxy is masked today with the manipulative techniques of psychotherapy. Women of Orthodox, Catholic, or Jewish origin do not easily break through the housewife image. It is enshrined in the canons of their religion, in the assumptions of their own and their husband's childhoods, and in their church's dogmatic definitions of marriage and motherhood. The ease with which dogma can be dressed in the psychological tenets of the mystique can be seen in this suggested outline for married couples discussions from the Family Life Bureau of the Archdiocese of New York. A panel of three or four married couples, after rehearsal by a priest moderator, are instructed to raise the question, can a working wife be a challenge to the authority of the husband? Most of the engaged couples are convinced that there is nothing unusual or wrong in the wife working. Don't antagonize. Be suggestive rather than dogmatic. The panel couple should point out that the bride who is happy at a 9 to 5 o'clock job has to think about A. She may be subtly undermining her husband's sense of vocation as the breadwinner and head of the house. The competitive business world can inculcate in the working bride attitudes and habits which may make it difficult for her to adjust to her husband's leadership. C. At the end of the working day, she presents her husband with a tired mind and body at a time when he looks forward to the cheerful encouragement and fresh enthusiasm of his spouse. D. For some brides, the tension of doubling as businesswoman and part-time housewife may be one of several factors contributing to sterility. One Catholic woman I interviewed withdrew from the state board of the League of Women Voters when, in addition to the displeasure of the priest and her own husband, the school psychologist claimed that her daughter's difficulties at school were due to her political activity. It's more difficult for a Catholic woman to stay emancipated, she told me. I have retired. It will be better for everyone concerned if I am just a housewife. At this point, the telephone rang, and I eavesdropped with interest on a half hour of high political strategy. Evidently not of the League, but of the local Democratic Party. The retired politician came back into the kitchen to finish preparing dinner and confessed that she now hid her political activity at home, like an alcoholic or a drug addict, but I don't seem to be able to give it up. Another woman of Jewish tradition gave up her profession as a doctor when she became a doctor's wife, devoting herself to bringing up their four children. Her husband was not overjoyed when she began brushing up to retake her medical exams after her youngest reached school age. An unassertive, quiet woman, she exerted almost unbelievable effort to obtain her license after 15 years of inactivity. She told me apologetically, "You just can't stop being interested. I tried to make myself, but I couldn't." And she confessed that when she gets a night call, she sneaks out as guiltily as if she were meeting a lover. Even to a woman of less orthodox tradition, the most powerful weapon of the feminine mystique is the argument that she rejects her husband and her children by working outside the home. If, for any reason, her child becomes ill or her husband has troubles of his own, the feminine mystique, insidious voices in the community, and even the woman's own inner voice will blame her rejection of the housewife role. It is then that many a woman's commitment to herself and society dies aborning or takes a serious detour. One woman told me that she gave up her job in television to become just a housewife because her husband suddenly decided his troubles in his own profession were caused by her failure to play the feminine role. She was trying to compete with him. She wanted to wear the pants. She, like most women today, was vulnerable to such charges. One psychiatrist calls it the career woman's guilt syndrome. And so she began to devote all the energy she had once put into her work to running her family, and to a nagging, critical interest in her husband's career. In her spare time in the suburbs, however, she rather absent-mindedly achieved flamboyant local success as the director of a little theater group. This, on top of her critical attention to her husband's career, was far more destructive to his ego and a much more constant irritation to him and to her children than her professional work, in which she had competed impersonally with other professionals in a world far away from home. One day, when she was directing a little theater rehearsal, her son was hit by an automobile. She blamed herself for the accident, and so she gave up the little theater group, resolving this time, cross her heart, that she would be just a housewife. She suffered almost immediately a severe case of the problem that has no name. Her depression and dependence made her husband's life hell. She sought analytic help, and in a departure from the non-directive approach of orthodox analysts, her therapist virtually ordered her to get back to work. She started writing a serious novel, with finally the kind of commitment she had evaded, even when she had a job. In her absorption, she stopped worrying about her husband's career. Imperceptibly, she stopped fantasying another accident every time her son was out of her sight. And still, though she was too far along to retreat, she sometimes wondered if she were putting her marriage on the chopping block. Contrary to the mystique, her husband, reacting either to the contagious example of her commitment or to the breathing space afforded by the cessation of her hysterical dependence, or for independent reasons of his own, buckled down to the equivalent of that novel in his own career. There were still problems, of course, but not the old ones. When they broke out of their own traps, somehow their relationship with each other began growing again. Still, with every kind of growth, there are risks. I encountered one woman in my interviews whose husband divorced her shortly after she went to work. Their marriage had become extremely destructive. The sense of identity that the woman achieved from her work may have made her less willing to accept the destructiveness and perhaps precipitated the divorce, but it also made her more able to survive.